Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report, Washington Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. The House sent a $460 billion appropriations bill to the Senate to avert a government shutdown. Additional Ukraine funding remains stalled. Super Tuesday leaves the race to the current and former president. Joe Biden gives what could be his last State of the Union address. Mitch McConnell happily endorses the man who insulted him, his wife, and his family. Russia tries to kill the Ukrainian president and the Greek prime minister with a ballistic missile that landed 300 feet from both leaders. Chinese spy tools are found on cranes made by China that operate in U.S. ports. The cancellation of the annual ritual press conference with Chinese leaders has many saying that the country has now fully tipped into authoritarianism. And Washington hosts Benny Gantz and says it will open a port in Gaza for humanitarian aid. Joining us today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific chair of the Hudson Institute think tank, who is joining us from Korea today in an early hour. Michael Herson, the president of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms. Former Pentagon Europe chief Jim Townsend, who is now with the Center for a New American Security and the co-host of the Brussels Sprouts podcast, a must for anybody interested in the transatlantic alliance, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations. Everybody, welcome back to the program. It is an honor and pleasure, certainly a big week. Patrick, very special thanks for joining us at what is a very early hour in Korea. Michael, it's in an overwhelmingly bipartisan, we'll get to the State of the Union in just a moment, but first, you know, sort of budgetary mechanics, in an overwhelmingly bipartisan vote, opposed overwhelmingly by GOP lawmakers of the 85 or so who voted against it, the House passed a $460 billion measure to avert a government shutdown that also cuts funding for three agencies that Donald Trump has incessantly vilified, the Justice Department, the FBI, and the Environmental Protection Agency. Talk to us a little bit about this deal, how we got here, what the Senate's going to do, and what it means more broadly for defense spending, given that, right, this is sort of a phased government shutdown approach that we decided to put ourselves through.
Well, they actually call it a laddered approach, but you're right. So, look, the House
all
passed.
It means is prolonged pain. That's all it means.
Yes, it does. And I'm feeling it. I'm living it every day. So, look, the House passed these six appropriations bills in one package on Wednesday, and as you mentioned, it was an overwhelming bipartisan vote. 207 Democrats voted for it. That means only two Democrats voted against it. And look, 132 Republicans voted for it. I know a lot voted against, but this was a majority of the majority. I think people were surprised by the big vote. And look, we expected the Freedom Caucus to come out against it, which they did. They slammed it for excluding a lot of the controversial policy riders that they had requested that highlighted the price tag. And now, you know, Bob Good, the new chair of the House Freedom Caucus, started lecturing his fellow Republicans in a leadership meeting earlier this week, saying now that they should shut down the government over FY25, right? We're not even done with FY24 yet. And he's already arguing for a shutdown in September for 25, so that Democrats can't lock in any policy wins before we might get a new president. And it's total idiocy because this guy doesn't even understand the system that he's trying to dismantle, because we're going to end up with a CR, you know, at the end of September. There's no way we're going to have FY25 bills done by then. So
I find it most interesting that people who have copies of the Constitution in their pocket fundamentally don't understand the Constitution. But anyway, but this was also a big win for Mike Johnson, just to give him credit for that.
No, it was. You know, they did get not only getting the bill passed, getting some of the cuts that they wanted, but, you know, they did get some of these earmarks dropped. For example, you know, some of the earmarks dealing with LGBTQ community centers were dropped. But the Democrats did get the extra funding that they were looking for WIC, which is a supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children, which we talked about last week. So Senate still, as we tape, is trying to figure out a process for getting it done today. I believe that they will. And then the president will sign it. And then we're on to the next one, which is more complicated, which, as you mentioned, includes defense and has a March 22nd deadline. Now, out of the there's six bills in this package as well. They feel pretty confident they can get five of these done. Homeland security is, as we've mentioned before, is continuing to be a source of trouble. And there was talk yesterday of the whole bill imploding and ending up in a continuing resolution for 1 year. If that's the case, they're going to have to do a fix to the FRA, to get rid of the 1% across the board cut, which I believe that they would do if we end up in that situation. So that remains to be seen. But this, we will have this wrapped up, I believe, by March 22nd, because again, the House will be going away for a 2-week recess at that point.
And just really quickly, I mean, do you think efforts to derail everything are going to succeed? You know, as I interrupted you a bit with my constitutional primer, but do you think that, right? I mean, there was a border deal on the table. It was what Republicans have wanted for a long time, and they said no to it, right? So it's possible that no legislation goes ahead at this point, right? I mean, how are you gaming this, especially as the race is now officially on after Super Tuesday?
Well, I'm not really worried about FY24 appropriations, but when you start talking about the border, that ties us into the supplemental. So that's where the real problems lie right now. And, you know, there's lots of different options on the table when it comes to the supplemental. And like I've said, I know I sound like a broken record, but I keep comparing this to Build Back Better because this is not going away anytime soon. And there's a lot of will to get this done. Now, we've talked previously about how Congressman Fitzpatrick and Congressman Golden have a bipartisan group of members that they have put forth what they consider a compromise supplemental that's, you know, kind of a pared down version financially and does include some border policy provisions in there. And they're actively working a discharge petition now to try and get that to the floor. At the same time, I was on the Hill yesterday talking to a lot of committee staff on foreign affairs and on armed services. There are multiple efforts like this happening behind the scenes. From the positive sign, it means a lot of people want to get it done. The negative sign, there's just too many proposals out there where I think the really only game in town is the Senate proposal. And now there's another effort underway by the national security leaders on the Republican side, apparently Mike McCaul, who chairs Foreign Affairs, Congressman Turner, who chairs Intelligence, and Mike Rogers, who chairs Armed Services, are working on a bill. And they felt that Johnson would agree to put on the floor, but Johnson now is saying today that he gave them no assurances and that he's had no time to think about this at all because he's focused just on FY24. Meanwhile, the Democrats, led by their Rules Committee ranking member Jim McGovern, are working on a discharge petition to move the Senate bill to the floor. There are House Republicans that have indicated they would sign it. I think right now they think they've got about 5, but they're going to need about 20 because they are going to lose Democrats on that bill. There is one other solution that's being talked about now, which I don't think is realistic. But since we're talking discharge petitions, which haven't been successful in over 10 years, there's an arcane rule which is referred to as taking down the previous question. So if the House Republican leadership brings a bill to the floor under a rule, there is a vote on what's called the previous question. If the minority defeats that, they then have the ability to bring up their own bill for a vote. The last time this happened was in 1988. And as you know, it's very rare now that we do bring bills to the floor under a rule because the Republicans can't pass a rule. So I think this is an unlikely scenario.
Dove, the administration is going to submit its budget request, defense budget request, and its government budget request to Congress on Monday. You know, as we record this, the briefings or background briefings are going on to help reporters better understand this. Walk us through what we should expect to see from this measure, ultimately, and what's your hope for what comes next in terms of at least approving some kind of budget, as Michael discussed, that gets us to some degree of regular order, at least through the end of the fiscal year.
Well, let me pick up on the last part because Michael was just talking about it. So I've been on the Hill today, this morning, I was on the Hill yesterday, talking to members, and one of the so-called normal or rational conservatives, very conservative, but not a crazy right winger, said to me that they were really pleasantly surprised that it was only 85 folks who opposed what was done this week. That person expected well over 100. To me, that's a sign, as Michael said, that I think the second part of this crazy exercise will pass. So that's pretty good news. Now on the supplemental, one thing I had heard, and I think I mentioned it on this program last week from a foreign ambassador, is that the EU would pick up the humanitarian part of the money for Ukraine, which is about $15 billion. Well, I spoke to a member about that, and apparently that's being kicked around too in the Republican caucus. Obviously the fundamental issue is what do you do about the border? But there are ways to mitigate the other sort of related problems that have been plaguing this supplemental. Now, what to expect for next year or next fiscal year, I should say. It looks like there's not going to be any real growth in the budget. There's going to be a decline in the number of ships that the administration is going to ask for, which really makes no sense, given that we need ships all over the place right now in the Middle East and in Europe, in the Baltic, in the far north, in the Pacific. So that's not good. But bear in mind, because I experienced this myself when I was in the Pentagon, the last year of a administration's budget is almost phony. Because if a new administration comes in, they're going to put in some kind of budget amendment. And even if the same administration stays on, that doesn't mean they'll be as committed to those numbers as they say they are right now or when they submit. And so watch this space, because things could well change once the elections are over.
I want to bring this back now and sort of expand it to the State of the Union. It really was do or die for the president, who, despite a roaring economy and dealing with some extraordinary global challenges, bringing allies together, whether to stand up to Russia or China, has been remarkably successful. And yet his polling is in the tanks, a lot of discussion about his age. Because Trump's base is literally ironclad, while Democrats are prone to perennial Goldilocks syndrome, there are big questions about what happens in November, where the president's polling is still bad. Key element of the State of the Union was making his case for allies and partners. He hosted the Swedish Prime Minister, Ulf Kristersson, who joined him. Sweden now the 32nd member of NATO, and called on Republicans to stand up to Russia and support Ukraine because the world and the future were watching. Michael, Ukraine is losing ground. We're losing ground to the Russians. It's literally running out of ammunition. Putin, I think is so empowered by watching all of this that he decided, well, I can attack Zelensky even if he's hosting the Greek prime minister. And if I kill both of them, so be it. How does this, first, your sense on the address, and I'm going to go around the horn in a moment, but does it change the prospects at all for the supplemental ultimately?
Sure. So look, I think the president did a great job last night. I think he was strong, forceful, aggressive. What people overlook too, he got up there and just started going. He didn't wait for Mike Johnson to give the normal formal introduction of the president of the United States. He just went right into his speech and he started out with Ukraine, which was the first time he has made the case for Ukraine in his State of the Union address. Now, this is a minor criticism. I do think that it would have been helpful for him to make the case as to not just a threat to democracy, but in Europe, but also why it's a threat to our democracy here and why our freedoms are affected by what's happening over there, right? I think he was very smart. One of my criticisms in the past is that he attacks MAGA Republicans and talks at them and not to them. In this speech, he didn't use the phrase at all, and he did talk to them. He talked to all Americans. He did his best to mobilize women by talking about IVF and bans on reproductive freedoms. He reminded people how great the economy is, that we've created 15 million new jobs in 3 years, which is a record, 50-year low for unemployment, wages up, inflation down. He talked about creating jobs here in this country, manufacturing jobs, and talked about the CHIPS bill, the infrastructure bill. And then he did, again, something unique. Instead of starting off a speech about the State of the Union is whatever, strong, whatever, he did that about a quarter of the way through his speech, that American necks knocked down, we get back up, and the State of the Union is strong and getting stronger. But that was very strong and powerful. And, he ended his speech talking about honor and decency and versus, the alternative of revenge and retribution, and, ended with some optimism and hope for the future. And I think it played very well. I mean, last night, polling showed that 62% of the viewers now say that Biden's policies are the ones that will move us in the right direction. The 9 o'clock hour last night was the best fundraising hour his reelection campaign had had since its launch in April. And the 10 p.m. hour was even better than that. So I want to have some optimism here because there's a lot of reasons not to be optimistic. I do not think The speech does move the needle much as far as Ukraine, the supplemental. I think the people who have their positions have them. The key on the supplemental is going to be getting Johnson to bring something to the floor for a vote. And that I don't think he's going to pay much attention to until after the recess. And then we're back here in April and the clock is ticking.
The clock indeed is ticking. And I should give you credit. You were among the voices who were advising Democrats in the administration not to, you know, belittle the former president's supporters, but rather try to win them over with logic and reason to see if he can peel away any of those who might not, you know, be it, who may have concerns about Trump, but are maybe not ready to vote for Biden. Jim, as Michael just noted, assistance still isn't getting to Ukraine in at the speed it's going to get there. Indeed, you could also make the case that Zelensky is also hanging on with his political life, right? I mean, if he can get this aid package, it helps him in Ukrainian elections that are just right around the corner. And there is some concern, you know, whether or not he does get reelected. You know, as he's noted, we're fighting for democracy and I have to live within the rules of democracy. Michael, I mean, the president did make a case that democracy is under assault, both at home and abroad. So he did make that link, even if some people didn't like the invocation of January 6th. From your standpoint, Jim, what did you make of the address? And then I want to take you to what you made of a Russian missile strike. I mean, that's as empowered as you get that hit 300 feet from Zelensky when he was hosting Kyriakos Mitsotakis, the Greek prime minister in Odessa.
You know, I on the State of the Union, I agree with Michael and a lot of what we've all been saying in terms of I think Biden had a good night last night. But a couple of things. One is I think some of his speechwriters were listening to our show over the past couple of weeks because he came roaring out of the starting gate. As Michael mentioned, and I noticed this too, before they can even go through the rigmarole of introducing and all the applause again and wasting more time, Biden jumped right into it. And what was interesting is I've listened to State of the Union addresses. See, I'm what, 67 years old? For 67 years, I've been listening to State of the Union addresses, and I have never heard them start off talking about NATO or foreign policy, particularly NATO. I mean, this is... something I've always had to explain to Europeans for years, why NATO never comes up in the State of the Union address. But it did. Right. And he did it in a way like we have been talking about, which is letting the people know, the American people know, that we are in a bad place right now internationally. And we have got to begin to focus on the threat to our democracy, as you pointed out, both domestically and internationally. And we have been talking about that on this show. And he launched with that last night. And so I cheered and said, it is worth coming to this podcast.
Thanks very much, Jim. And I hope everybody heard that. There you go. Thank you, White House. Thank you, Mr. President.
That's right. But I will say, though, that I do wish his delivery, you know, we've all talked about his age, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, got that. But the place where you really feel it, though, is in his delivery. And that's because What concerns me most about it is because a lot of his important good points are missed because his sentences run together like mine do, of course, but it matters more for him than me. But I just mourn the fact that a lot of the concern about the economy and all this type of thing among the American people, if there was a more effective voice for this administration, that could really get out there and would have the reach to be able to say, look, let me explain the economy and why your misapprehensions are not well placed. The administration just doesn't have someone that can do that. And I think that's the problem. And one of the communication issues that has plagued this the administration the past couple of years. John Kirby is great, but he's not the president. But anyway, so that's where I am on that. And quickly on the missile attack. Vago, I think we have to wait for some intel or some more insight on whether that was the intent and that was the target and that was the, you know, missile strikes. You can have things like this happen. and is not necessarily a targeted assassination attempt using a missile, but it was more of an errant missile that just happened to hit as close as it did. So for me, the jury is still out on what was the intent of that missile strike.
I mean, the Russians said they were aiming for a depot, but a nearby depot for unmanned vehicles, unmanned naval vehicles. I don't buy it. If you have any sense, you're not shooting a missile anywhere near the Greek prime minister, right? So, I'm sure that there could be some forensics that eventually come through and somebody could have squeezed off around, but more likely they were delivering some kind of message. Is my sense.
Vago, it could very well be, but I don't want to stake my reputation on something before I wait to get more intel.
indeed. Well played. You did spend a lifetime in policy and diplomacy. And I would point out, right, I mean, I think that everybody knows that the president does have a stutter. And so, you know, sentences can run together and he can trip up even if he's practiced it. If you look at his notes with the notations that he makes to ensure he delivers a smooth address. Although I would argue they're so worried about the president tripping that they don't allow him to talk. And actually, when they allow him to talk, he actually does a pretty good job and is very candid.
Right.
I thought his comment about Xi Jinping being a dictator, that's unimpeachable. He is a dictator, especially after how things went this week. Patrick, you are joining us from nighttime Seoul. Walk us through how the State of the Union, what you perceive to be the messages that the president delivered. I mean, one of the things he said about China is that this is, you know, that his administration seeks competition with China, but not conflict. At the same time, talking about all the ways to build up America to better be able to compete against China, despite the unfortunate information that came out about Chinese supplied cranes in American ports. I don't know why on earth this took a congressional commission this long to finally conclude it had espionage devices on them. No shit, Sherlock would have been, you know, my take. Give us your take on the State of the Union and how it was received by the audience in Asia.
Well, I can certainly talk about the Koreans. I was in the Philippines before and talking to six different countries, including the Quad countries, but that was before the State of the Union was delivered. I mean, for me, of course, being 81, but in command and in full campaign mode was a welcome wake up for the president in the White House that he's fully engaged in charge. And that was good news for me. But for the Koreans here, I talked to yesterday, they were just surprised that foreign policy was so prominent. They had come to expect foreign policy to be always essentially left out of this domestic speech. So they were very happy to hear this commitment to American leadership. But at the same time, you cannot go to a meeting here in Korea or talking to the Japanese or the Filipinos without hearing about the Trump risk. And for Koreans, that means the potential that Trump gets elected and they talk about withdrawal of troops or jacking up the cost sharing price to Seoul or, you know, promoting engagement with Kim Jong-un that could have dire consequences for South Korea's North Korea policy. Meanwhile, they're worried about whether Biden's tough rhetoric on supporting Ukraine against Russian aggression could suddenly be turned around after that election. So they love the speech, but they're still worried about American reliability. And that's the question that you'll hear repeated from our allies and partners in the region. And I heard that in spades with all of our allies and partners who were there at my meetings in Manila. So that doesn't go away just because the president gives a good speech, but it does help his campaign prospects. And therefore, it increases the chances of continuity in U.S. policy, which is a very welcome sign. And it reminds me that when Jim Townsend was 2 years old listening to Dwight Eisenhower's State of the Union speeches, and I believe he probably was because he knows so much about NATO, you know, people are looking for that kind of continuity in American policy. They do not want us to falter from American leadership. They need it now more than ever, even if they're willing to contribute and shoulder more burdens than ever before, too. President Yoon, for instance, is proven that he has a values-based global policy. is willing to do whatever it takes to keep the U.S. Alliance strong, even increasingly talking about standing up to China. And that's a sea change from previous Korean governments.
And is there a palpable concern about a change in Washington next year? I mean, is there palpable concern of the return of the Trump administration and some of the tactics that certainly the Koreans, unfortunately, were subjected to, whether it was about burden sharing or anything else?
Yes. palpable is an understatement. It is the driving concern. The first thing, the second thing, the last thing in every conversation I've had with senior officials, with foreign policy experts here in Korea, but even again with the Japanese, with the Australians, with the Indians, with the Filipinos, all this week here in Asia, they're all concerned about discontinuity, about unpredictability, about sudden shifts. Even if they have varying degrees of confidence that they could manage and work with the Trump administration, you know, here in Korea, for instance, we had Alison Hooker, and we had, you know, who worked so closely with Robert O'Brien, and you know, Matt Pottinger was here, and there were people, very good people, who were part of the Indo-Pacific team in the first Trump administration, essentially reassuring folks here that there would be good people to work for. And I certainly hope that's the case, because they are good people and they would represent a certain continuity. But the Koreans and the Japanese know that Trump makes his own decisions and is subject to impulse and is very transactional. So all of those are of great concern, and they're all trying to hedge their bets and figure out how do we prepare for that possible disruption, even while we would like to see the continuity of a Biden administration.
Indeed, there were a lot of strong people in the administration, but the issue was the boss, and whether, and a lot of it, unfortunately, was driven by the caprice of the boss. Speaking about capricious bosses, Dove, you have heard a couple of these States of the Union as well, and probably could recite the most important ones from memory that you've heard through the Cold War and the decades since. Other big news, obviously, was on Gaza. The president hosted Israeli hostage families while also calling for a ceasefire, and also the international coalition he's helping forge, that includes the European Union as well as Britain, to bring aid to Gaza by sea after the U.S. military in a few weeks builds a temporary causeway to allow rapid unloading of aid, given the gravity of the humanitarian crisis. Gaza health officials, or I should say Hamas health officials, say that the death toll is above 30,000. Most international organizations agree with that, although some point out that nearly a third of those are Hamas fighters, whereas the rest are civilians. Some 2 million have been displaced, and there was a lot of criticism of Israel for slowing down humanitarian aid. The announcement the president made during the State of the Union also came a day or so after his vice president, Kamala Harris, met with Israeli war cabinet member and opposition leader Benny Gantz, enraging Bibi Netanyahu. David Cameron, Lord Cameron, the British foreign secretary, followed suit and met with Benny Gantz in London as well. What did you make of the address overall? And then what specifically about the president's proposal, and whether or not it helps him out of a tough bind? He's loyal. He's staying loyal to Israel. And that has a lot of Arab Americans pretty enraged at him. Arab Americans he needs to win in November.
Well, the proposal wasn't just to win Arab Americans, quite frankly. It was to win younger Americans. It was to win minorities that have sympathized with the Palestinians' plight. The overall speech, I agree with what was said. The real issue is, did he move the Nikki Haley people? Because that's the key. They're not independents per se, but they're clearly not happy with what he called his predecessor. He never called him by name. And remember, Katie Britt, the senator from Alabama, who had the Republican response, which was actually a pretty good response in the sense of, you know, she's a mother, she's a homemaker and so on, or was, she's not running for president. And Mr. Trump, in his usual style, came across criticizing the president crudely. And in a way, it kind of underscored what Biden was trying to put across. By the way, part of Biden's problem, I think, is he has difficulty reading off a teleprompter. If you paid attention when he was going after ad-libbing and going after Republicans, including some of the members of the Supreme Court, he didn't trip up. It's right. Reading the teleprompter. And quite frankly, you know, the question is, do most Americans watching TV recognize that he's reading from a teleprompter? They may not. And that could be a little worrisome, because then people say, you see, he slips and so on. He didn't actually slip very much when he was just speaking off the cuff. On the peer issue, look, this was clearly an effort in two ways. First, as much as he cares about Israel, and he does, he's also a humanitarian. And so what he was doing, I think in his mind, is totally consistent with being a supporter of Israel. Obviously, it wasn't going to satisfy Rashida Tlaib. She had that little sign up, ceasefire now. But it might satisfy some of the other elements of the Democratic Party that do have an humanitarian impulse. What it's done, though, is reinforce what the crazy right in Israel has been saying for the last few weeks, which is, oh, you see, Biden's backing away. Biden really doesn't support us. Because those people, and I would probably include the prime minister of Israel in this, want 1,000% support for whatever they damn think they should be doing. And so there's already been criticism of this port idea. By the way, when Gantz was in Washington and in London, speaking about the two-state solution, about the humanitarian issue, about what comes next, he did not have a security detail protecting him, because the prime minister of Israel decided that since Gantz didn't coordinate personally with him, yeah, if he gets shot, he gets shot. You know, you kind of wonder, there's such a race to the bottom between guys like Trump and Netanyahu and some others. You just don't know where the bottom is anymore.
And I think that's really, I didn't know that actually. And I think that that's so unfortunate given, you know, the extraordinary career Benny Gantz had and the sheer number of people who would love to kill Benny Gantz, frankly, is just deplorable. I want to shift, you know, go ahead, Dove.
Well, I was just going to say, I think one indicator of Biden's sort of really trying to reconcile both sides of these issues is he did have the hostage parents up there as his guests. He talked about the hostages. Very often, people who criticize Israel don't mention the hostages at all. You see this in columns and newspaper columns and so on. So he did talk about that. Again, this was part of his view, his humanitarian view. You want to help the Palestinians. You want them to be able to have medical, food, et cetera. But you also care about the hostages. Again, it's not going to satisfy extremists on either side, but it is consistent with the way the president looks at the issue.
I want to take a quick minute for a shout out for all of our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and his family of publications are brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo, DRS, and American Rheinmetall. I want to get to Michael, just hold on for one moment, because we're going to talk a little bit broader politics, but I have two couple of quick follow-up questions. First, Dove, just to follow up on Israel, is there any change going to happen in Jerusalem as in the wake of this, right? I mean, the U.S. is not going to be putting boots on the ground in Gaza. The president made that clear, whether in Ukraine or anywhere else, even if France and Emmanuel Macron admirably continue to ask the question, hey, what happens if we ever have to put troops in Ukraine? And I think that that's a very important discussion. From your standpoint, does any immediate vector change? So has the president effectively bought Netanyahu another couple of weeks of combat operations by doing this? I mean, how is this going to play out, especially when the president was delayed getting to the House chamber by demonstrators who'd blocked off the approaches to the Capitol? A lot of demonstrators.
Yeah. Look, I think, again, that's why he had came up with the or the administration came up with this idea of a causeway or a pier or whatever you want to call it. There have been some things going on in Israel that, again, put Netanyahu in a corner. The president has probably given him a few weeks. But for instance, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have started their lessons learned on what happened on October 7th. That's not going to be good for Netanyahu. The Shin Bet, the intelligence agency, has basically refuted the right wing, which said that there were all these Palestinian workers inside Israel who were spying for Hamas. And the intelligence people have said, no, it wasn't. Now, the real question is, what happens with a ceasefire? This time, it's Hamas that's the problem, it seems. Hamas has said that we'll only support a ceasefire if all Israeli forces are pulled out and won't even give a list of the living hostages. And that's what the Egyptians are saying. It's not what the Israelis are saying. And I think that Hamas would like this war to go into Ramadan. As I think I mentioned last week, the last Ramadan war was started by Egypt in 1973. But Hamas would like to see that because it'll simply energize more people against Israel. So in a way, they have an incentive not to cut a deal. But that's going to create problems for Netanyahu as well. The real issue, of course, is can he be forced out? And I think a lot of that has to do with how Gantz feels about it. If Gantz pulls out of the government, maybe he can get a few Likud people to go with him and bring this government down. But it's going to be very, very hard. And so ultimately, if in a few weeks' time, when more people are being killed and they're being killed during Ramadan, that maybe the United States will start to get a little more open and forceful. Right now, we're less forceful and less open than we have been up to now. Whether that'll even move Netanyahu is unclear, but it's going to push him very hard. I think that's you got to watch for the next couple of weeks.
And certainly one of the big concerns is, unfortunately, that with this death toll, whether or not there's going to be a wave, sort of as a friend of mine put it, whether, we're looking at Daesh 4.0, whether in 4, 6, or 8 years from now, as we've historically seen in the wake of these kinds of operations. So, and unfortunately, we're reducing FBI spending somehow because we think that that makes sense. We're going to go into a little bit of lightning round because I want Michael to talk to us to start us off on a little bit of some of the political dynamics, because there was some big news, which I didn't think was surprising at all. Nikki Haley lost and Mitch McConnell supported, Donald Trump. Wow. Newsflash. I think we should have seen those buses coming. But really quickly, Jim, I want to jump up to you. Viktor Orban came to the United States, rebuffed the president and the administration. He's not holding any meetings with them, but he's down at Mar-a-Lago to meet with Donald Trump, his political populist authoritarian soulmate. You and I were going back and forth, and I suggested maybe Biden should go to Budapest and meet with opposition leaders and then fly home and ignore anybody in the Orban government. What does this kind of a maneuver, ultimately mean? And what's the right way to sort of deal with it, right? I mean, the United States always tries to be high-minded about it, although I suspect if Donald Trump had been in office and Orban had done that, there might have been a message going to the U.S. embassy saying, figure out a way to smack him around. Anyway, what does this mean, ultimately, if anything?
I think the way to handle this is to ignore it. Orban is a fly on the butt of an elephant. In this case, Donald Trump. We should not worry about it. Orban has already blotted his copybook over the past, couple of years, but particularly with Sweden. And while if you're an EU insider, you've been watching Hungarian and Orban shenanigans for a long time now, but the rest of us out here in the US and other places saw what he did with Swedish entry into NATO, showing that this guy is a two-bit player. And so the fact that he's going to go down to Mar-a-Lago to kiss the ring of Donald Trump just shows how petty and and minor a person he is. Dealing with this, dealing with what to do in response, it's not worth anyone's time. We move on. Let's just wait till the political wheel turns and maybe he's voted out of office sometime. But right now, we just ignore it and we pedal on.
Ignore it and pedal on, indeed. I thought you were going to mention that he was kissing something else other than a ring, but you had a lot of forbearance this week.
Well, I already used the word "but" when I talked about the elephant. I didn't think I should do it twice.
Yeah, that was well played, Townsend. Patrick, I want to take you to the question of the ritual annual press conference, right? I mean, for many decades, you know, once upon a time, if we went back a couple of decades, they were very meaningful, right? Even if it was set piece, it was an opportunity for the international press and indeed, once upon a time, for a pretty vigorous Chinese press to hold their leaders to account and ask them all manner of questions about, you know, everything from their dapper suits to actually big economic questions that actually some of those leaders would answer with remarkable candor. As the Chinese economy has been derailed by Xi Jinping's own policies, that press conference was this year eliminated after the big party sessions. And it's prompted Chinese commentators to say, yep, it's official, we're in authoritarianism now. It is only one thing. It was set piece. It wasn't as though folks were, you know, but it was still seen as something necessary. Anyway, put that into context and how important this decision was and what it means for the Chinese government as they dynamite their own successful economy upon which their legitimacy resides, right? You trade your freedom in China in exchange for economic growth. Keep your mouth shut and you'll get a good job and a pension and get to travel aboard and buy some luxury goods. And that's not the case anymore.
Xi Jinping is cutting China off from the world. And it's befuddling to a lot of people who want to do business with China. It's befuddling to some Chinese academics who are saying, look, you're not going to let us travel. It's undercutting the foreign ministry's propaganda that China is open for business and there to help. The cancellation of the press conference was just one action, but it does illustrate a whole set of actions that are underway under the Xi Jinping leadership that is decoupling the information, the technology. They have a new document, of course, that emerged from, it was written in September of a couple of years ago, but still it is the new policy out of China to talk about delete America from all Chinese technology. So they don't want information out that is not comporting with the CCP party line narrative. And I was watching the Xi Jinping meet with PLA and People's Armed Police delegations at the National People's Congress as part of this two sessions going on. And you couldn't make any kind of detailed analysis of what was being said because it was all political verbiage about discipline and modernization and jointness and loyalty. And, you know, but it sounded serious. and the serious part of it is that we are now totally loyal to Xi Jinping and the party, and that's the message. So they're getting the message and they're following it, just like they're ramrodding the national security law through the Hong Kong right now without any opposition. This is the new China, and the new China looks a lot like Mao.
Indeed. And the China of Mao didn't look all that good. Just ask virtually anybody Chinese that you know. Michael, you know, walk us through, right? I mean, it's been a busy political week. Now the focus is, right, Nikki Haley's out, Dean Phillips is out, so it's between Biden and Trump. But there's also worth watching that RFK Jr. is in the race and the woman who helped Trump get elected in the first place, you know, Jill Stein, is in the race as well at a time that folks are looking for another candidate. The No Labels folks are going to put their candidate forward one of these days. It's been said that it will happen today. Anyway, walk us through what any of these dynamics mean, because, you know, I think our foreign friends get focused on the fact that Joe Biden won the last election with 10 million more votes than Trump, but that doesn't matter. 20,000 votes in Wisconsin is what matters, or the same amount in Michigan or in Pennsylvania, right? Walk us through
a little bit of where they are and what, if anything, Mitch McConnell's dutiful. I mean, I don't know why anybody thought he wasn't going to endorse Trump. And by the way, the last thing I would say is the White House says the polling on Trump is wrong, right? That somehow Biden is stronger. I think they're missing it. I think Trump is a lot stronger than people think he is. Trump supporters just don't discuss it. They only discuss it if they think you're a Trump supporter, and then it comes out. Anyway, give us this sense on some of the political dynamics, what happened this week and what does it mean? And then Dov, I want to end it by coming to you. The PPBE reform is now out, and I would love you to weigh in on that. Michael, take it away, and anybody can weigh in on this discussion as well, but go ahead.
I say there's a lot to unpack from the weekend politics, and I'll start with the polling since you mentioned that first, because the polling is very disconcerting for the president. There was a poll that came out that showed that 97% of the people that voted for Trump in the last election are still going to vote for him again in 2024, but only 83% of the people that voted for Biden plan to vote for him again in 2024, with 10% of those saying they would vote for Trump. That to me was absolutely stunning. I don't understand how anybody who voted for Biden in 2020 could vote for Trump in 2024 when things actually got worse after the last election. Trump's favorability in those polls show him at 43%, which is still not great, but Biden's favorability is at 38%. His job approval is at 36%. And for some reason, his performance in the economy, people rate it as poor at 51%. Only 7% say it's excellent and 19% say it's good, which is why I'm glad he addressed that in the State of the Union address last night. So those numbers are very disconcerting. So Super Tuesday also, I think, was concerning in a lot of sense. Like, you know, there's mixed things happen. So for one, look, I think we got to mention that Adam Schiff won his primary. They have a jungle primary in California. Now he faces Steve Garvey, the Republican, in the general, which means that he is going to win. Katie Porter, if she had come in second place, it would have been two Democrats facing off. Katie Porter has been anything but gracious in defeat, and she's now claiming the election was rigged because all the money was spent against her. Not a good look for her. Congressman Jerry Carl on the Defense Appropriations Committee
we should just briefly mention, right? She's also out of her House seat, right? So she's got a little bit. She's a little bit more upset than she might otherwise be, right?
Yes, but she's already looking at what office to run for next, and I think getting support for this next run is going to be harder. When you're a Democrat claiming the election was rigged by another Democrat who was very widely popular. Right. So, you know, Jerry Carl's loss was a big blow to the defense community. He had served on armed services, was now on appropriations. He was beat by Barry Moore, who is no fan of defense. He votes against CRs. He votes against the NDAA. He votes against defense appropriations. You know, and then in North Carolina and the 8th District, we had this guy, Mark Harris, win his primary, whose election was overturned last time because of he had hired somebody to cook up some absentee ballot harvesting scheme. So because of fraud allegations, he was taken away, had to give up his election win. And now he's going to be in Congress because that's a seat is a very Republican district. And look, I think it's important to note, too, what happened on the gubernatorial race in North Carolina. This guy, Mark Robinson, who is now looks very poised to be the next governor of North Carolina, is being praised by Donald Trump as Martin Luther King on steroids. He described the Global 19 as a globalist conspiracy to destroy Donald Trump. He said he wouldn't be surprised if the moon landings were fake and that 9/11 was an inside job. He makes anti-Semitic remarks, regularly quotes Hitler, wants to go back to the time where women couldn't vote, and refers to homosexuals and transgender people as filth. I mean, this is the depth the Republican Party is starting to sink to. And we saw some of that even last night with the behavior of Marjorie Taylor Greene, wearing her MAGA hat in violation of the House rules and heckling the president, showing no respect or regard for the institution. Same with Congressman Van Orton from Wisconsin, yelling lies when Biden was talking about his predecessor. You know, so I think, you know, we walk away from Super Tuesday with some concerns. Now, look, despite the fact that Nikki Haley did win the D.C. Primary and did win the Vermont primary, she did drop out. I think it's important to note the D.C. primary was before Super Tuesday, and that the Trump team was telling registered lobbyists who live in D.C. that they were watching who was voting. And if you don't vote in the primary, you're going to be shut out of their White House. Now, right. Sure, a lot of those lobbyists did vote, and they voted for Nikki Haley. But that's, again, another warning sign for those who are concerned about our democracy and our liberty, that the Trump people don't seem to understand that people can vote for whoever they want to vote for, or they can choose not to vote at all. His daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, also came out this week because she's now going to be the new co-chair of the RNC, saying anyone who doesn't support Trump and MAGA will be told to leave the party. Look, with Nikki Haley out, I think that she's leaving the door open for her supporters to support Trump. I'm not so sure Trump's going to change. He's not going to earn her voters. I think you raise a really good point about no labels. It looks like they are going to launch a candidate. My gut tells me I think Chris Christie is going to be their candidate. Let's see what happens there. And Biden had some warning signs in some of these states that he won. He won overwhelmingly, but you know, in Minnesota, uncommitted got 19%. You know, no preference got 13% in North Carolina, 9% in Massachusetts, 8% in Colorado, and the same thing in Tennessee. So that still remains a problem. And some guy named Jason Palmer, who no one ever heard of before, won the primary in American Samoa, which also threw everybody for a loop. But I think that the president still has a chance to reset things. And I think last night's State of the Union address gives him that chance to do it.
Anybody else from the team want to weigh in on any of the broader political drivers before Dove talks to us about the final PPBE reform report?
Well, let me just say about what Michael just said. I suspect that a lot of people who voted for Biden last time and say they'll vote for Trump is because they're terribly worried that Biden isn't going to make it through 4 years, and they don't really like Harris. He may have helped himself tremendously in that regard last night. He certainly didn't look like somebody who couldn't make it the next 4 years. But that may underlie some of the problem. And I think the real issue is, will these third-party candidates once again skew the presidential election as they've done in the past?
It happened with Anderson. It happened with H. Ross Perot. And, you know, the Jill Stein people are not deterred at all. They're like, ooh, if we could just get it to 5%, we become a legitimate future party. Right. Alas, even if her activities actually launched into office a president who undid all of the climate related stuff that she allegedly proposed, I find it to be a bit madness. But, you know. Anyway, we can all dream. Dove, really quickly, give us a sense on the PPBE final PPBE planning, programming, budgeting, execution, reform report, and what it ultimately means, because it's not all that different from the interim report.
Well, that's right. Look, to put it in, try to put it in non-wonkish language, this system has been around for 60 years more. And when you're dealing with a system that's 60 plus years old, dealing with technologies that emerge every few years, and new threats from China and old threats from Russia, you got to change the system. And that's really what this report was about. They came out with 28 recommendations. A whole bunch of them are things that the Defense Department can do itself. Some of them Congress has to do. I think it was a pretty good report, not all that different from the interim, and you know, maybe not as path-breaking as some people would have hoped. But speaking on the Hill to one of the report sponsors today, that Congressman, I simply said, look, if you're going to try to move the bureaucracy, you don't move it by breaking all the China. Then they just resist. This might be seen maybe as the camel's nose under the tent. More reform is probably necessary, but this report pushes it at least in the right direction and makes it clear that the system has to change. So all in all, I'd give it a pretty good rating.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Patrick, thanks so very much for staying up so late. So I hope you get a couple hours of sleep before you've got to be back up again. Hope everybody has a great weekend, a great week. Looking forward to having you back on again next week. And a quick reminder to our audience to check out our award-winning weekly podcasts, Cavas Ships, hosted by our very own Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with our own Laura Winter, who takes a very thoughtful look at all things space, and our Air Power podcast, sponsored by GE Aerospace, that I co-host with our own JJ Gertler. Hope everybody has a great weekend, and tune in again on Sunday for our business roundtable. Until then, hope everybody has a great weekend and a great day. See you again soon.